Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is John Hodgman, who reads from and discusses his hilarious new book, The Areas of My Expertise, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Thank you. Thank you for moving up, everyone. Now that we're closer, we can do. I can do a nice intimate little number. This is a love song. I hope you appreciate love as much as I do. I will wait a lifetime if it takes that long. I know she's out there, for I have heard her song and dreams she sings to me. Her angel's voice, a symphony. Is she in a garden or a meadow fair? Does the dappled sunlight shine ribbons in her hair? Does she sit patiently, smiling as she waits for me? She's my millionaire girlfriend, she's my life. Once I finally find her, I'll get permission from the wife. We will all live in our castle high. My beloved and my millionaire girlfriend and I. She's a stolen secret from a pirate's chest. I will wear an ascot and a suit that has a vest, and I will put it on as I watch Gardner mow the lawn. She's a fairy princess from a song of old. I will have a toothbrush that is made of solid gold, and I will watch TV as my manservant flosses me. She's my millionaire girlfriend, she's my life. Once I finally find her, I'll get permission from the wife. We will all live in a castle high. My beloved and my millionaire girlfriend and I. Does not matter to me if she's pretty. All accounts is what she's got at Citibank, Chase, Manhattan, or even Washington Mutual. When my search is ended, I will cherish her. She will sign some papers, give me power of attorney, and what's hers will be mine in perpetuity. She's my millionaire girlfriend, she's my life. Once I finally find her, I'll get permission from the wife. We will all live in our castle high. My beloved and my millionaire girlfriend and I. My beloved and my millionaire girlfriend and I. My beloved and my millionaire girlfriend and I.
Thank you.
just get this pick out of my pocket here so we can continue. Now is the time when the world really needs him. Wisdom is out of our reach. Out of the wasteland there comes a redeemer whose only desire is to teach. Don't waste your time at some fancy college. Forget that, it's too much to read. He's got a book of complete world knowledge. It's all you'll ever need.
Good evening. Good evening. My name is John Hodgman. As you may know, I'm the author of a book entitled The Areas of My Expertise. That is actually the shorthand title of my book. The full title of my book is as follows: An Almanac of Complete World Knowledge, compiled with instructive annotation and arranged in useful order by me, John Hodgman, a professional writer in the areas of my expertise, which areas include matters literary, matters historical, matters cryptozoological, hobo matters, food, drink, and cheese, which is a kind of food, lobsters and squirrels and eels, haircuts, utopia, what will happen in the future, and most other subjects.
Most of the subjects include having asthma and tipping in fancy hotels, terrible haircuts and dungeons and dragons, monsters and magical spells. All of your travels are finally over. You're safe now, there's nothing to fear. So tip back a glass of your favorite beverage. You're lucky to be here, 'cause tonight you're holding a key that fits in a lock, that opens the door, that shows you a room, that's holding a heart, that's pumping the blood, that's feeding your brain with information. Sweet information. Sweet information.
Thank you. That's Jonathan Colton, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for being here in a very, very cold place in the mountains when you could be home and warm. I appreciate it. As you may know, before I became a professional writer, I was a professional literary agent. And it was my job at that time to give advice to writers. And writers always wanted to know, what do I need in order to be a successful writer? And my answer was always the same. You first of all need the willingness to endure an unusual amount of solitude, which is difficult. You need to convince yourself that the world has to hear what you have to say. Now, there are some people who just naturally feel that the world has to hear what they have to say. These people are, excuse me, these people are assholes. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, children, but that's the way it is. And they generally are not very good writers either, but you do need to convince yourself at least. Obviously, you need special stationery, you know, with a picture of a quill and an ink pot at the top, maybe, or a typewriter, an old-fashioned typewriter with a piece of paper coming out that has your name written on it and then the word writer. You know, if you want to be taken seriously, you need that. Obviously, you need to be able to describe facial hair accurately. Not an easy skill, as I'm sure you know, sir. Sir, as you as well. And, of course, you need a really good, and you as well. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to overlook you, sir. I don't know how I would begin to describe your facial hair. And you also need a good theme song. And what you heard just then was my theme song. Every writer should have a theme song, but it's difficult to have because it's hard to find a good troubadour. Jonathan Colton is my troubadour. He is actually the contributing on the masthead. I'm sorry that I touched you.
That's okay.
Yeah. He's actually on the masthead of Popular Science magazine as contributing troubadour. And that is an actual, that is a true fact, perhaps the last true fact that I will relate to you tonight. So savor it. And it's really quite a feat that he is on the masthead of any magazine, considering that, as you can see, he was raised in the woods by forest creatures. I found him wandering the woods of southern Connecticut. He did not even speak English when I found him. Since he had been raised a feral child, he spoke a click language of his own devising. But he was very clever. He made that shirt out of chickadee hide or something himself. And he was always a very talented musician. He always played guitar beautifully, but of course, you know, he did not call it the guitar. He called it the clang. Excuse me. Did I get that right, Jonathan?
It was close.
Yeah. But he was singing very beautiful literary theme songs even then, albeit in a click language. So I thought I would take him back to civilization and shave him as best I can and bring him on the road with me to sing my theme song. And I taught him English, and now you can see he speaks very well.
Yes, thank you.
It's astonishing, isn't it? It's beautiful.
Good evening, kind ladies and gentlemen. Denver is very cold.
No. It almost sounds like words.
Thank you.
Yeah. As you may know, my book is a compendium of fascinating trivia and historical oddities, much like the old Book of Lists and the many American almanacs and samplers that preceded it, I should say, with the distinction that in my book, all of the amazing true facts are made up by me, and thus paradoxically more truthful. Of course, the first American almanac of any note that included information beyond the simple, you know, predictions of the seasons and the movements of the stars and phases of the moon and the tides and that sort of thing, which is all very valuable information if you happen to be a sailor or a farmer or a werewolf or something. But the first popular almanac for normal humans was Poor Richard's Almanac, which was written pseudonymously by Benjamin Franklin. It's a very famous almanac. I'm not a big fan of that almanac. I found it suspicious that he wrote it under a pseudonym, for one. And for two, Franklin pushes very hard on the bifocals in his book. He's really, you know, he had just invented them, and so it was full of all sorts of witty aphorisms about bifocals, you know, a bifocal in time saves nine, and then all sorts of instructions about how to make fireplaces out of bifocals and, you know, electric kites out of bifocals. It was too much, I thought. I thought that he overdid it. But it does contain, within its pages, the first printing that we have of the Six Oaths of the Virtuous Child. The Six Oaths of the Virtuous Child, of course, was a recitation used to open every school today in America, in 18th century America, back when public education in America mainly meant standing by a wood stove and reciting things and then being hit. And long before the Pledge of Allegiance was written, this was recited. And perhaps elderly gentlemen like yourself will recall this and thus will not need me to lead you in the recitation. But for the rest of you young people, it's a nice way to start an evening of fake trivia. So I hope you'll join me in reciting the Six Oaths of the Virtuous Child. Just repeat after me when I indicate with my hand, thusly. Okay. Thusly. Yeah, there you go. Very good. Six Oaths of the Virtuous Child, circa 1733. Today shall not be wasted. I shall rise before the sun, so that I may then watch my family as they sleep, with intent waiting eyes. Very good. I shall honor my mother today, and I shall tell Father he is powerful. Today I shall be clean. I shall not touch my teeth, knowing that the oils of my skin shall cause them to disintegrate. Instead, I shall sharpen them twice a day with a good steel. I shall be a child of faith, and I shall ever make science my enemy. Also eels. At day I shall perform my chores and duties happily. And if I see an eel, I shall kill it. And now with feeling, please. At night I shall dream of more labor.
At night I shall dream of more labor.
And in my sleep I shall smile with sharpened teeth.
And in my sleep I shall smile with sharpened teeth.
Knowing that today has not been wasted.
That
concludes the six oaths. You should give yourself a round of applause. You did a very good job. You sounded like school children from the 1730s. The actual children left. It's a shame. I would have liked to have them recited. But their mother was like, I'm not going to let that asshole say asshole again around my children. And you know, she was right. I can say, as a parent, she did the right thing, though it's unfortunate for our time together. When I speak in public about my many areas of my expertise, the area that most people are interested in, of course, is the hobo matters. Jonathan and I had this plan to screen for you a PBS-style documentary that we were making about the hobos, the wandering folk of the Great Depression who hopped boxcars, etc., wore the same pants every day. You understand who I'm talking about. Bearded folk, usually. And it was going to be a great documentary. It was going to be like a Ken Burns documentary. It would have an old-time picture of a hobo, black and white, naturally. And I would do some narration, and Jonathan would play some annoying folk songs, and the camera would pan slowly over the hobo this way, and then more narration, and we would pan back over the hobo this way, more annoying folk songs, and then we'd do a slow zoom in and fade out. It would just be one photo of one hobo for the entire documentary. It was going to be an extremely cost-effective documentary because we did not have many funds to begin with. But as you know, the estates of the various most famous hobos are quite litigious and protective of their image, and we could not get the right to the particular hobo image we wanted, or indeed any hobo image. Most hobos, it turns out, did not show up on film, curiously enough. So that also proved to be something of a challenge. So unfortunately, we were unable to proceed with our documentary and can only now present to you the skeletal approximation of what it would have sounded like and sounded like as I present to you now the hobo matters. Are you ready, Jonathan?
Yes, I'm ready.
Very good. And here I shall read from my book. They called it the war to end all wars. They called it the London Fire, and they called it the Trail of Tears. But they were all wrong. It was called the Great Depression, and the hobos saw it coming. 1929, October, Black Thursday, the 24th day of October, 1929. The day the stock market crashed, instantly wiping out $30 billion in value. Soon after, the Bank of the United States would collapse, trapping all inside, many of them orphans. After a decade of high-flying prosperity, the economy of the United States fell to earth and then began tunneling to an awful volcanic core of despair, food riots, annoying folk songs, and lava. By March, 250,000 apple sellers would crowd the streets of Manhattan, desperately refusing to sell any other kind of fruit. But apples and sellers alike were easy picking for the hobos. There have been hobos in the United States since there have been trains and liquor, which is to say, always. But by 1930, an estimated 2 million broken souls had taken to the wandering life, hopping boxcars, picking up work where they could find it, and drinking, drinking, drinking. In many ways, they were a nation unto themselves. They had their own currency in the form of hobo nickels, regular buffalo nickels that they would deface with a penknife to carve in new images on it and then pass on for goods or services, or attempt to pass it on anyway. So a buffalo nickel, for example, might be recarved to look like a hobo dressed as a buffalo. They had other little handicrafts of their own, lint knitting. They were very into lint knitting. They would go from town to town. They would take the pills off of sweaters that were hanging out on clotheslines and knit them into new sweaters and then attempt to sell them back to the original owners. They're very crafty, the hobos, very sly. And of course, they had their own language of signs and scrawls and hieroglyphics, that they used to alert to passing brethren to danger and opportunity. They would scrawl these things on barn sides or on picket fences, and a cross, for example, on a house would mean to another hobo that religious talk would get you a free meal there. Or a stick figure of a woman with three triangles would mean a woman lives here alone with her children. Or alternately, a woman lives here who is very fond of triangles. Three stars, of course, meant beware. The sheriff in this town is handy with throwing stars. And then, of course, there's a famous one, which I'm sure you all recognize. This was referred to as the H in sun rays, and in 1932 it was seen on one day throughout the United States. And boxcars, picket fences, carved into mashed potatoes at diners, chalked on the back of policemen's uniforms, stomped in gigantic proportion into cornfields so as to be seen by above, from above, by whom it is unknown. And this H in sun rays, of course, meant that it was time for the hobos to take over the United States government. When in the spring of 1932, great masses of unemployed veterans descended upon Washington to urge the passing of the bonus bill, the hobos came with them. They took advantage of the confusion to infiltrate the White House, pocketing sandwiches and replacing Secretary of the Treasury Ogden Mills with one of their own, Hobo Joe Junkpan. He was the only Secretary of the Treasury who was a hobo in our history. His term lasted about 2 weeks, and he was chased out by Hoover's pneumatic militia. But some of his amazing innovations are still with us today, such as the repeal of the bindlestick tax. This is why your bindlestick is not taxed. If you have a lake of moonshine on your property, say, or cigarette trees, also no tax. Unfortunately, his most sweeping innovation and most interesting was his plan to allow all Americans to make their own nickels out of anything they wished. Wood, lint, he recommended lint very highly. But this was dismissed as so much hobo nonsense, and it was never enacted, although economists now agree that had it been enacted, it would have wiped out the Great Depression just like that. While they were in power, the hobos wrote illiterate letters to newspapers. They wanted cheap beer and warm hats. They wanted bent nails and pieces of string. They demanded half barrels of swallow feather sauce, and no one knew what they were talking about. At his inauguration in 1933, a new crippled president named Roosevelt addressed the nervous crowd. He promised a new deal against the hobos. "The people of the United States have not failed," he said. "In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous action. And so, I will kill all the hobos, and together we will gnaw on their bones." The president knew there was really only one way to end the hobos' march across the blighted land: polio. Alone in his secret fireside lab, Roosevelt created a concentrated serum of the dreaded disease that would be placed in the nation's water supply by the Tennessee Valley Authority. According to his contemporaries, Roosevelt was tortured by his decision. He knew that a certain number of non-hobo citizens would spend the rest of their lives in iron lungs, non-recreationally, as a result of his actions. But it would finally put a stop to the wandering people, starting at their feet and ending at their waists. Then came Pearl Harbor. Some say Roosevelt knew the Japanese would attack that infamous December 7th. The truth is he didn't, but the hobos did. And as quickly as they had come, after Pearl Harbor, the hobos mysteriously disappeared. No one knows precisely where they went or why. Some say they found patriotism in their hearts, joining the war against our common enemy, Europe. Others say that they went to the stars or to another dimension. And still others say that they live on today, moving quietly from town to town, preparing for the time when their great chicken bone and moonshine empire will rise again. Is it possible? No. Most serious historians agree they probably went to the stars. But if you live near a railway track and listen as the train passes, it is almost as if you can still hear them singing, the dark and lonely wind of history still blowing from their rotted lungs.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fires were burning, down the track came a hobo hiking. And he said, boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for the land that's far away, beside the crystal fountain. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
This song, of course, is the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Many of you will probably recognize it as a kid's song. It's used in a lot of movies and fast food franchise television commercials in a lot of different forms. It's a famous American folk song, but it's not a kid's song. It's an old hobo song originally, describing the great hobo Valhalla, known as the Big Rock Candy Mountain, where all hobos hoped to go when they stopped wandering after all. It would be a place full of cigarette trees and handout trees and lint trees, a place where there would be lakes of moonshine and rivers of gin and wells of whiskey and rain of scotch, which is a kind of whiskey. You see what I'm getting at. They loved the spirits, especially if they could drink it out of the ground. And so, you know, when you listen to this song, that's what this is describing. And I'm sorry, Jonathan, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to give that context. So please continue.
Thanks, John. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, and the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. The boxcars are all empty, and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Sorry, I have to interrupt one more time. I apologize, but when you sang lemonade springs, it got me to thinking. You might think that's odd. Lemonade is not intoxicating. Why would the hobos want it? Well, in a way, it's ironic that this song came to be known as a kid's song, because, in fact, some folklorists believe that it was written for kids. And this is a rather dark, actual, true fact that I discovered when I accidentally did some research for my book. And I actually did regret it more than usual, having done the research, because what I learned was that, as I say, folklorists know that most hobos would go from town to town, and they would hope to lure kids along with them, young teenagers, what they would call rogue kids, usually young men, to do their begging for them and to do work for them and to do other things for them. And so these folklorists believe that this song, as I say, is sort of a Pied Piper-type song to describe things that children love, such as lemonade and cigarette trees, to bring them along on the road. You don't hear these lyrics very much anymore these days. It was all cleaned up by Burl Ives. But in fact, we found some of the original lyrics that we're going to sing for you. Well, Jonathan will sing for you now. And if you listen closely to the original lyrics of Big Rock Candy Mountain, I think you'll hear they tell a somewhat darker story. Go ahead, Jonathan.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, you never change your socks, and little streams of alcohol come trickling down the rocks. So your socks get good and stinky, and you're always good and drunk. It's the bestest time that you ever had. You won't miss your friends or your mom and dad in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a hole that's full of treats, and the rocks all taste like sugar drops, and the dirt is nice and sweet. You can eat some as you work the mines to bring me precious gems. There's a hobo shed and some paint made of lead. You know you're done a painting when you wake up dead in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. I love the tender crisp bacon cheddar ranch. The breasts there grow on trees, and streams of bacon ranch dressing flow right up to your knees. There's tumbleweeds of bacon, and cheddar paves the streets. You get to veg all day, all the lotto tickets paid. There's a king who wants you to have it your way at the Tender Crisp Bacon Cheddar Ranch. The Tender Crisp Bacon Cheddar Ranch.
Come and get it. Thank you, Jonathan Colton, for singing that lovely song. So this is where we normally do the question and answer portion of the program, whereby you ask questions and I attempt to answer them. Now, this is a big book of fake trivia. Obviously, when I read from it, when I write, I'm sort of in a kind of this character of this, you know, expert John Hodgman. And, you know, I don't really do the question and answers in any sort of character at all. I'm just someone who wrote a book, and I have some experience and some made-up experience. But I'm happy to answer, you know, questions within the world of the book or just points of curiosity that you might have about my grooming or or Jonathan's grooming, such as it is, you know. Obviously, you can imagine how this sort of intimacy makes me uncomfortable. So if we were to do it at all, I would prefer that we do the question and answer via walkie-talkie. Excuse me. Now, this is going to work very simply. Or if you don't have a question, you may just pass it along. And eventually it will find a question. Now, I hope you are all trained in the usage of long-distance speaking machines. All you have to do to speak into this walkie-talkie is to depress this orange button on the side somewhat firmly. You speak into the walkie-talkie like this, and when you're done speaking, you say over and you undepress. Over. Just like that. And you will know that I am calling you and ready for a question when you hear this sound.
Hello, hello, this is John Hodgman. I am ready to answer your questions. Is there anyone out there? Over. If you do not have a question, please pass the walkie-talkie along as swiftly as possible. I am ready to receive your question. Over. My media escort and employees of the Tattered Cover are not allowed to ask questions, so do not give it to them. Over.
What's your handle? Over.
That's okay. You can hang on to it while I answer your question.
Did everyone hear the question?
Out there in the world? Over. The question is, what is my handle? You mean my nickname, my CB nickname? Over.
That is correct. Over.
Well, this is technically just a walkie-talkie conversation, not a citizens band conversation. But usually when I'm speaking wirelessly, I go by the nickname of Sweet Daddy Champagne. Over.
Oh, may I ask you a question? What is
your handle, sir? Over.
My handle would be Big Roger 05. Over.
Thank you, Roger. Over and out. Hello, hello, this is John Hodgman. I'm looking for new friends. Is there anyone out there? Over.
Yes. You seem to go to great lengths to tell people that you're lying in the book. Why do you do that?
First of all, I'd like to commend you on your walkie-talkie etiquette. It is unusual that someone will actually say over. May I ask, first of all, what is your name and where are you calling from? Over.
My name is Jesse. I'm on the aisle, fourth row. You can see me. I'm holding my hand up right now. Over.
I can't see you. I'm using a walkie-talkie. We're seeing you at a great distance. But, Jesse, I think your question is very good. Why do I say that I am lying? Well, the actual answer to that is that I felt that it was necessary to, first of all, admit that I was lying to avoid lawsuits. And as well to invite the reader in a little bit. My feeling was that if I just told these lies over and over again and did not sort of acknowledge the falsity of it all and make that part of the joke, that it would eventually become tiresome and would lead to the inescapable conclusion that I am deranged. And I did not want this to appear as some sort of bizarre work of outsider art. I wanted to actually have a the caller. What is your name, sir? Over.
Meth Rocker 5, over.
What's happening, dog? Good to hear from you. The caller is referring to my contributions to a public radio program called This American Life, and also my contributions to a cable television show called The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. This is not over, I'm just pausing. If I hold down the button too long, it makes a very annoying noise, which is not me speaking, a different noise. But here's something I'll bring you in on. This American Life is not an NPR program.
It is
actually a PRI program, which is a very, very important distinction within the world of public radio.
Because
NPR and PRI are direct competitors and hate each other. And if you ever see an NPR person in a room with a PRI person, it's like taking two cats and setting them on fire. And you'd best stay out of the way. And there's been many a time when I've gotten a little bit of a dressing down from Mr. Ira Glass because I referred to something, the show, as being an NPR program. And he said, please, 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 tell the people, Public Radio International. Now, as for, you know, whether or not I prefer to do stuff for that show or the other, I mean, they're very different programs, but they're both intensely brilliant things that I was a fan of long before I ever had the luck to be invited to contribute. So you're asking me basically to choose between my children. I'll say The Daily Show right now. We'll see down the road. We'll see what happens. That concludes my answer. Over. This is John Hodgman. This is John Hodgman calling. There's a little button just beneath the data window on your walkie-talkie that says call. If you're out there and you wish to ask a question, please hit that button right away. Over.
This is Nina 05 calling. Over.
Hey, Nina, it's good to hear from you. Did you hear what I said about the call button, though?
Negative. Over.
Okay. If you look at your walkie-talkie, you'll see a little window that has the number 5 in it, and just below that, there's a little button that says call, and that's how I know that you want to speak with me. Over. Come back, 905. How are you doing, good buddy? This is John Hodgman. Over. Where are you at?
Keeping the pedal to the metal. Thank you, John. I have a question. Where did you get your crazy sense of humor? Over.
The question is, where did I get my crazy sense of humor? That is the question that you know most comedians and humor writers love to hear. I love to answer that one. It's hard to say. I mean, it's just, you know, such a, insofar as, you know, I can make any jokes that make people laugh, I'm as astonished as you are that it happens, and I don't know why, and it's a sort of tissue of all sorts of different influences, from TV to friends to, I mean, Jonathan was a big influence. We've known each other for a long time, mainly in the realm of beard humor. Peter Cook and British comedy was a big influence. Various other friends that I knew and stole jokes from. I don't think that's an adequate answer to your question, but it's really all I've got, 905. Is that acceptable to you?
What kind of relationship do you and Jonathan have? Brokeback Mountain fashion, over.
That's an American Western. We are from the East Coast of the United States. We do not have that sort of relationship. We are both happily married to different women. Although we are friends, obviously. Recently, though, it was interesting because in Los Angeles, someone that we knew, who was it? We were doing an event in Los Angeles, and someone that we knew Angeles. You never see that. It's very... And so we laughed and laughed and laughed. But then she told us what they were saying, which was this bizarre coincidence. Like, oh, you should go to this theater tonight to go see this reading with these different people, including this guy, John Hodgman. And the other person, who was a woman, said, boy, I'd like to go to a social with him or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, go on a date or something. And the other person said, oh, you know, he's very gay. I was thinking, why is someone coming to that conclusion, apart from my obvious sort of, like, lack of manly attributes? You know, orange tie and so forth. Something to do with the fact that I'm traveling around the country with a bearded guy wearing buckskin? We'll never know. But thank you for your probing and completely inappropriate question, 905. I think we have time for one more. For you.
This is John Hodgman. Hello?
Hello, this is John Hodgman. Broadcasting from the stage, looking for any sort of question you may have to ask, even if it is relatively personal. Over. Hello, are you out there? Go ahead, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Over.
My name is Paul Getty, but I'm not related to the gas station, and I would like to know what's with the shoes, man.
The question is about the shoes. Are my shoes perhaps the least gay aspect of my attire? These are called Vasque. Never heard of this brand before. Just in Marin County. And in a strip mall doing a reading there, and right across from the street, this was last Friday, was a store that sold shoes. And I've been wearing the same pair of shoes every day for a year. The prior pair of shoes had been bought here in the state of Colorado and were no longer functional. So I bought these for $90.
And,
got a terrible blister on my left heel as a result. So far, so good, is my feeling. I hope that answers your very functional question. That question being, what's up with the shoes, man? In case anyone didn't hear the question. Does that answer your question? Paul Getty, not of the Getty fortune, gasoline fortune. Over. Yeah.
Is there anyone who would like to ask a question not on the walkie-talkie? Or shall we move on? Let's move on. Thank you very much. Yeah. You can do some applaud for... Cover up, giving back the walkie-talkie applause. So I'm going to close the reading now with the Hobo's Code. More hobo material. People love the hobo material, and who am I to deny what the people love? As I mentioned, you know, there wasn't a lot of research that I could do on hobos, and certainly even less that I wanted to do. And the reason is because the hobos didn't leave many records. Those hobos that were not illiterate were intensely superstitious and especially distrustful of ink. For unlike chalk or coal, ink could not be washed away by rain and time, and thus was considered by the hobo to be a perversion. Hobos considered forgetting to be an honor to the world, which of course forgets each of us in every moment as it passes. And in the makeshift rail yard camps known as jungles, it was considered a virtue if you could legitimately and purposefully forget anything that had happened to you a week or a day or an hour before. The exception to this rule was the hobo nicknamed Mindbender Steve, the hobo poet, who scratched out tales of boxcar life in the margins of the newspapers he had fashioned into undergarments. The other hobos hated him for revealing their secrets and eventually chased him into exile, and he died in Paris in the 1960s. And before he died, he sent a letter to the New York Times saying, "Some think that it is a crime that I invented hobo poetry. All I can say in my defense is, at least it was not cowboy poetry. At any rate, his most famous work is A Hobo's Code, and it really is the definition of what a hobo thinks and feels. One thing that we could not have time to get into, but is reflected in this poem, is the intense dislike that hobos had for tramps and bums. A subtle nuance, to be sure, but one that the hobos held very strongly and angrily in their hearts, as these sorts of, you know, tribes define themselves by their hatred of others. Tramps and bums are each hateful in their own way to the hobo. And the other thing that you should be aware of as we read through this poem, I'm not going to ask you to recite anything, you'll be glad to know, is that Mindbender Steve believed very strongly that all poems should be rhyming poems, even when it becomes intensely awkward and nonsensical. So, A Hobo's Code. And maybe Jonathan will play a little music to go along with The Hobo's Code. A hobo always goes and goes. He does not stop to change his clothes. He rides the rails that he has chose. Water pours out from a hose. Do not show me tramp or bum. Tramp may ride, and bum's a chum. But both beg from the other one. Kids, stop chewing gum. Neither works like hobo does, carving coin and twisting fuzz into a pretty pair of gloves. The past tense of to be is was. A hobo, he will never steal, unless it is to get a meal, or cash, or gems, or fur of seal. Some Japanese eat broiled eel. But saddest those who do not ride at all, but stand and die inside, as world spins on and throws aside the past and hope and faith and pride. In one direction do trains glide, not looking back on windward side across the continent's divide. The hobo rides and rides and rides. I will eat anything that's fried. Thank you very much. That concludes the presentation. I think we have one more time, well, a little bit more time just for one more song from Jonathan Colton, who's brought along some CDs, which he's going to sell for cash if that's okay. He'll take the money and everything else. Very reasonably priced compact discs. And I'll be happy to sign anything that you wish, and I hope that it is a book that you have bought from this bookstore. Otherwise, you're probably crazy. But I'll still sign whatever it is, a kitten or whatever that you've brought along with you, and then that will conclude our evening together, and you can all go home and get warm. Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Colton.
This is about a evil genius in love.
Welcome to my secret lair on Skullcrusher Mountain. I hope that you've enjoyed your stay so far. I see you've met my assistant, Scarface. His appearance is quite disturbing, but I assure you he's harmless enough. He's a sweetheart, calls me master, and he has a way of finding pretty things and bringing them to me. Oh, and I'm so into you, but I'm way too smart for you. Even my henchmen think I'm crazy. I'm not surprised that you agree. If you could find some way to be a little bit less afraid of me, you'd see the voices that control me from inside my head say I shouldn't kill you yet. I made this half-pony, half-monkey monster to please you, but I get the feeling that you don't like it. What's with all the screaming? You like monkeys, You like ponies. Maybe you don't like monsters so much. Maybe I use too many monkeys. Isn't it enough to know that I ruined a pony? Making a gift for you. Oh, 'cause I'm so into you, but I'm way too smart for you. Even my henchmen think I'm crazy. I'm not surprised that you agree. If you could find some way to be a little bit less afraid of me, you'd see the voices that control me from inside my head say I shouldn't kill you yet. Picture the two of us alone inside my golden submarine. While up above the waves, my doomsday squad ignites the atmosphere. And all the fools who lead their foolish lives may find it quite explosive. Well, it won't mean half as much to me if I don't have you here. You know it isn't easy living here on Skull Crusher Mountain. So maybe you could cut me just a little slack. Would it kill you to be civil? I've been patient, I've been gracious. And this mountain is covered with wolves. Hear them howling, my hungry children. Maybe you should stay and have another drink and think about me and you. Oh, 'cause I'm so into you, but I'm way too smart for you. Even my henchmen think I'm crazy. I'm not surprised that you agree. If you could find some way to be a little bit less afraid of me, you'd see the voices that control me from inside my head say I shouldn't kill you yet. I shouldn't kill you yet. I shouldn't kill you yet.
That's Jonathan Colton. My name's John Hodgman. Thank you very much for your kind attention. That is all. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 17th, 2006.